I'm Dr. Stephen Holt, and I facilitate the Bond Oversight Committee. And we want to welcome you to today's, or December 3rd's Bond Oversight Meeting. Thanks for coming. It's great to see you. We've got a full house, and this is not the greatest sound system, so we're going to do our best to speak up and encourage everyone else to speak up. A couple of kind of housekeeping items. If you've not been in this facility before, right outside that back door to your left and then on the right hand side are the restrooms. There's a water machine right outside. There's also some on the table. So a couple of just logistic issues. But then secondly, and most importantly, this is a meeting that is open to the public. This is not a public meeting. Let me explain the difference. It's open to the public in that the information that's going to be talked about is information that is identified on your agenda. It is the items that will be covered in the discussion, and the Oversight Committee will interact with the Portland Housing Bureau staff, but this is not an opportunity, or you get the privilege of hearing, listening, and capturing what's going on, but this is not the opportunity of a public engagement environment where then you can come to the table and ask questions and have those questions asked or answered or responded to. And we're glad you're here today. We very much encourage your involvement. And if you have thoughts, questions, concerns, or need further information about items concerning the bond, I'm going to have all of the, or each of the, employees of the Portland Housing Bureau, please raise your hands so you can identify who you are. Look around the room, and those are the people, thank you very much. Those are the individuals to grab, ask for a business card, ask for an opportunity to meet with, talk to, and follow up with them. You will notice on your agenda there's also a segment for a two-minute testimony. And that two-minute testimony means exactly that. You're going to have 2 minutes to come and share, express your idea or thought, if you so choose, at the end of the meeting. So, again, welcome. We are glad you're here, and we are going to get things rolling. We're going to start with roll call. We'll begin with the committee members of the Bond Oversight.
Susan Emmons, Bond Oversight Committee member.
Todd Struble, Bond Oversight Committee.
Jess Larson, Vice Chair, Bond Oversight Committee.
Hi, I'm Alan Lazo from the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. I'm a Bond Oversight Committee member.
I'm Carl Dinkelsbill, the Affordable Housing Programs Manager, and today the, I guess, sort of pseudo-acting director.
I'm Tanya Wolfersberger. I'm the Bond Housing Program Coordinator.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Chang with the Policy Team at the Housing Bureau.
Stacey Jeffries from the Housing Bureau, admin.
Wonderful, thank you very much. Shannon, the director of the Portland Housing Bureau, is not here today. So where you see Shannon Callahan identified, Carl is sitting in for her and will lead our discussion. So, Carl.
Okay. Jennifer, do we have minutes for these fine folks over?
The draft minutes from our October 4th meeting should be in your binder. Hopefully you had a chance to review them. We can take a moment to, if you have any questions or requested edits to that. And if not, we can take a motion to approve.
I motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Any more discussion? Vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, thanks. Great. Okay, so thank you all for coming again. I was just looking at the history of this group. We've been meeting since July of 2017, so 18 months or so, time for not one but two babies. One was the original bond, and the second one is a constitutional amendment. So, yeah, here we are birthing the second, or starting out on our second life here. So I wanted to to, I guess, start the meeting with an acknowledgement. First of all, thank you to all the Bond Oversight Committee members, and especially thank you to Jess Larson, who has been with us for that entire 18 months. Jess, I think you would like to say a little something here.
Sure. Thank you, Carl. Like many of you, I'm very thrilled with the outcomes on election night. I'm very excited to be here and having the conversation about what the passage of the constitutional amendment means for the implementation of the Portland Housing Bond, but also very excited about the implementation of the new regional housing bond, Measure 26-199, also passed on election night. And in my professional life, I will have a role in helping to implement that measure as an employee at Metro. It's with some sadness, but also with continued enthusiasm for this really important work that I am going to have to step down from this role serving on the Bond Oversight Committee so that I can focus my professional time in coordinating and working with all of you at PHB and continuing to work with community leaders like my esteemed colleagues here on the Bond Oversight Committee to make sure that both measures with the new constitutional outcomes are successfully implemented and create the thousands of affordable homes we need across the region. Thank you. It's been just the greatest honor to be able to serve in this capacity. I want to thank Commissioner Saltzman, who appointed me to the role, and thank just all of you for being so dedicated to this work in creating a program from scratch. This has been no small undertaking, and I am incredibly proud of what we've been able to do in just 18 months, and look forward to working with all of you in the coming many 5 years or so while we finish up implementation and then get implementation underway for the regional housing measure too. So thank you. I should say that I will resign my post effective at the end of this year.
Well, thank you so much, Jess.
I've got something I just wanted to give to
Jess. Please. Thank you, Susan.
In housing advocacy, we have a tradition of silly items, but this is for you to keep your eye on us, which I know you will on everything that's going on.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Jess.
Thank you, Jess. It's been a pleasure to have you. What I'd like to do is to, again, pass the baton here and turn it over to Tanya Wolfersberger, who's going to give us a few updates, or just the basic updates on our project. The project so far you've heard about, I think, for several meetings now. So, Tanya, if you want to...
Sure. I think before I go through project updates, we have a few other updates related to the bond program. I'll ask Jennifer and Martha to come up and provide some of those.
Okay. Hi, it's Martha, the Housing Bureau. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a little bit sick, so this will be brief. I just wanted to give the committee an update that we will be producing an annual report in the next 2 weeks, certainly with the intention to distribute it this month. And one of the components of which you've all seen in kind of the various materials that we've put together for these meetings. But one thing we did want to include is a letter from the Bond Oversight Committee. I have drafted together just an initial draft as a starting point that I will share with you now and give you all an opportunity to look it over, and then I will contact you to get your thoughts, your feedback, any edits that you might request.
Questions for Martha? I'll ask a question. Will we also be able to review the report before? Like, I'm assuming this letter pertains to a report. Can we?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
I just wanted to give a brief update on the audit of the bond. As you'll recall, back in July, our city auditor's office selected the Portland Housing Bond as an item that they're reviewing in an audit. I believe our colleagues from the auditor's office are maybe in attendance today. And
in the summer, they began with some interviews with staff, Home Forward staff, and I think a few of you as well, and some of our partners in the bond. And then this last month, they've clarified and finalized the focus of the audit, which is three main areas. They're looking at the criteria for project selection, and that the city has established them and uses them consistently to ensure that the goals of the bond are met, and then also whether the city and Portland Housing Bureau have systems in place to ensure that the bond housing is being made available to the intended populations. So those are the main areas they'll be exploring, and over the next several months, city staff as well as others will be reviewing documents, and they'll be reviewing and just conducting the rest of their audit and over the next several months. So, and then related to audits, there's also another update that the Housing Bureau is close to selecting our third party auditor. And so this is the one as part of the requirement of the bond that we are conducting an audit of the bond with a third party auditor. And we released an RFP earlier in the fall and hope to make that selection by the end of this month. And so we'll provide that information to you once available.
Okay, so we've got a few updates on our bond project so far. Just real quickly, again, you've seen these before, our five identified bond projects. The Ellington, we just received our award letter for project-based vouchers for that community, so really excited. That will allow us to overlay 52 vouchers on the community. So the next steps with that will be beginning the application and screening process for the existing tenants of that community to see if folks qualify and are interested in receiving vouchers. So we'll start there and we'll provide updates as we go along. So it's good news for that community. We also have resident services coming for the Ellington as well, which has been long overdue. So they'll get some extra support through that process as well. Powell, 30th and Powell, the architects are doing feasibility analysis work currently, so that will feed into larger design work going forward. 105th and Burnside, we have currently 39 occupied units out of the 51. So all of our studios, one bedrooms, and eight of our two bedrooms at 60% area median income are full with tenants. And we also have four of our two bedrooms at 0 to 30% AMI have been occupied, and those are our units with project-based vouchers and supportive housing services. So 12 more to go. We're really getting there. It's really exciting. As you may know, West Wind, last Friday, we became the proud owners of the West Wind building. We're really excited about that. We're Central City Concern has stepped in to provide day-to-day management services and support services for the residents of that building. We're going to start on some immediate security measures and repair, cleaning and repair improvements for that project, as well as just kind of getting to know the resident population in a better way. So that's a very brief and quick overview of where we're at with all of those projects.
Any questions from you? Go ahead.
Tanya, on the project-based vouchers for the Ellington then, so they're getting overlaid onto existing residents, so we have residents that are going to receive rent assistance, essentially, or are we going to be able to bring new residents who otherwise wouldn't have been able to get into otherwise affordable units?
We have some requirements that we need to offer those vouchers to existing rent tenants first, so we'll be developing that system and then creating a wait list from there.
So is the assumption then that those would be tenants who are paying rent at a higher level than they're able to? Or what will be the process for?
They'll have to go through application and screening to see where they qualify income-wise, and go through the the project-based voucher screening application process for qualification and unit inspection and all that to get through that process. So it's really just offering existing tenants that support first, and then it'll become available to next available unit.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh, yeah. And then, as always, we just like to remind you where we're all located here on the bond so far. So this map shows all five of those projects and the locations that they reside in throughout the city.
Just in terms of the Ellington again, just to be clear, I think it's great that there are these 52 project-based vouchers, and it's like catch-up because we said we wanted units available for people at 0 to 30% of median, and this makes that a reality. So I think that Alan's question is, it's conceivable that there are people living there who are paying more than 30% of their income for rent, and if they pass through the whole process, they will be at that income level. They may be paying too much. It took this long process to get the vouchers identified and to get the people screened, but it will be truly affordable to them who are already living there. And that's a plus, is what we had hoped for.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. I don't have that information in front of you, but you may have it in your binders from meeting before last or the one before that, where we had the demographics report. And I believe that we had already identified that we thought that at least 69 tenants probably could qualify for vouchers at that time. So we're going to go through that group to get them to an affordable level.
Go ahead.
May I ask a somewhat a policy question about because of the challenges of taking a building that's acquired and hopefully leased up, but knowing that in order to overlay the project-based vouchers, you have to offer them to existing tenants, and that means the existing tenants who would qualify are experiencing likely some hardship in order to stay housed, waiting for those vouchers to happen. This is sort of looking forward through implementation of future acquired buildings. Do we think it applying Section 8 vouchers to leased up and acquired buildings is the right approach, or would it be better to apply future vouchers to empty buildings like the 105th and Burnside or to be built buildings so that the vouchers can be applied ahead of tenants occupying the buildings, if that makes sense?
I think there's a pros and cons. Obviously, I think, you know, when you're dealing with an empty, vacant building, everything's a little bit easier. You can move a little bit more quickly through all of the processes. But I will say that I think, you know, the intention of the Portland bond was to preserve affordability and to create affordability where it doesn't exist and where there's vulnerabilities and opportunities to provide affordability to existing tenants. So I think that now we're a little bit farther along in our processes and developing policies and procedures for implementing things like project-based vouchers and the policies around over-income tenants and all of that. We're able to move more quickly on future projects than we have been at the Ellington, just because that was such an early acquisition that kind of preceded many of the policies and procedures that we have now.
All right, so we are going to move on to, I think, the biggest news of at least the last month, anyway, for us, which is thanks to the voters and a lot of people, hard work, people, including people in this room, that Measure 102 passed, which creates really an unprecedented moment for affordable housing. This is uncharted territory. We now have an affordable housing bond, which passed 2 years ago, as you know, and Measure 102 allows us to potentially lend those funds for affordable housing or to participate in artificial entities. So, and like I said, this is sort of uncharted territory. So the Housing Bureau, and I guess Metro to the same extent, but the Housing Bureau in particular is very much engaged in figuring out how that's going to work. So we have, you can go to the next slide. So the first piece, one of many pieces that we're working on is sort of the legal options or the legal ideas around this. So when this idea first came up, I said, you know, there's probably some things that we need to find out about this, right? They're general obligation bonds. We're used to lending tax increment financing and federal funds like home and community development block grant, but no one has ever lent geo bond funds into some kind of partnership or tax credit entity or what have you. So the first set of questions, the first thing we'll be doing is asking various attorneys for their ideas about how this would actually work. So we've developed in-house with, let's see, my team, the Home Forward team, folks from the attorney's office and the Office of Management and Finance, developed about 25 questions or so that are very specific. There's a general one that you can see here on your, I think you have this in front of you, right? The work plan activities for 2019, is that in your packet?
It's behind the presentation.
Oh, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll see there, I think hopefully that was sent out to you all. You'll see that this general question there, that is, what if anything is different about lending general obligation bond funds to a third party as compared to BHB's traditional sources of funding? So that's the overarching question. We've developed, like I said, 25, there's probably infinite questions, frankly, but we have a list of about 25 questions that we'd like to go through with our bond counsel and potentially another third party counsel, or outside counsel, I mean. So that's one of the things that we'll be doing right away. We have to sort of make some arrangements with our counsel and the various outside counsel to do that, but we'll be doing that shortly so we can feel more comfortable with lending these funds. So some of the questions that we're talking about are, what kind of entities can we lend to directly to our partners, single purpose entities like limited liability corporations. Obviously the most important question, I think, or most maybe complex one is low-income housing tax credit limited partnerships. So those will all be things we will be exploring, what might be the issues that come up when we do that. Understanding the differences between our traditional sources of funding and this particular source, what risks are involved, what expectations we might need to set with our partners around this kind of funding, and then some specifics that we care quite a bit about in terms of lending. For example, how do you have default provisions, or how do you subordinate, or how do you ask for repayment or have regulatory compliance. So all those things will be questions that we're asking various legal opinions on, or at least legal advice on. So that's a next step for us. That is an important next step. It's not the only one, but that's an important one that we'll do right away. So questions on the legalities. You'll have other. This all sort of rolls together as we go through this agenda here. So, so a related question, one that had come up, and I think you were all briefed on this, was a concept that was from our sort of previous leadership at sort of the City Financial Office of Management and Finance about lending geo bond funds to other entities or entities that would own the assets. So, the liability was the bond itself. And the asset would be the affordable housing that was developed as a result of the liability. And the question had arisen is, well, the city is responsible for the debt, the liability, but somebody else owns the asset. So that had been a question that came up in the sort of previous previous financial, the folks that were running the City of Office of Management and Finance. That question seems to have taken a slightly different turn with our new leadership there. Seems to be more optimistic about that possibility of sort of divorcing those two things, if you will. But we're going to need to get confirmation on that. I think there's sort of lingering questions about just that basic idea of assets and liabilities. So we feel pretty optimistic at the moment. I don't want to get ahead of our colleagues down the street, but. We feel pretty optimistic that we can get there. A comment from our debt manager was something like, well, there are other significant unfunded liabilities that the city has that are significantly greater than a $250 million bond. So that was an interesting and telling comment. So that's another piece of, it's not exactly a legal question, more of a financial question, but another piece we're going to have to iron out before we start lending these funds. So third question, so questions on the first two pieces from the committee? No? Okay. So I'm going to ask Jennifer and Tanya to talk a little bit about community engagement activities, which is another thing we'll do early on.
Hello again. So as you can imagine, with the constitutional amendment, we have opportunities to go out and do more community engagement and outreach. Really, you know, like keeping in mind the original framework, you know, we're going to be checking our implementation assumptions, particularly once, you know, some of these legal questions are answered. And it's an opportunity for us to continue to gather feedback and, you know, see if there's other priorities that we aren't considering that we may need to incorporate, or additional steps to our implementation plan that we need to incorporate. So particularly with the question around leveraging and whether we can enter into these public-private partnerships, we'll be doing some community engagement and outreach around that question. And then also it's an opportunity for us to just check in with all of our community partners, kind of mid-course corrections and any recommendations and feedback that we might want to gather at this point in time. So we'll be kind of honing in on what our outreach and engagement plan will be. I see that we'll have, I believe we'll have a plan in place and begin activities at the beginning of February, if not sooner. Jennifer, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but yeah, it's kind of a nutshell. It's just an opportunity for us to really go out now that our environment has changed.
So is that a chance to revisit the framework that we've been operating on for the last 18 months? Or is, like, are we going to be engaging the same stakeholders, or will it be a broader net because of the constitutional amendment? Or what are your thoughts on what do we do with the framework that we've already had?
I don't think that we're looking at making huge changes to the framework at this point, sticking with the current framework at hand, but we'll be looking at kind of how broad and how narrow we those particular topics and the engagement partners that we want to reach out to. So it may be a combination of some smaller groups depending on specific questions that we're looking for feedback on. We don't want to reinvent the wheel of all of the feedback and engagement that we already gathered through the original framework process. So we want to make sure that that we're asking specifically on kind of new priorities and new implementation plans.
Does that make sense, Todd?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I think the focus will be more on the environment that's created as a result of the constitutional amendment, right? And the fact that we will be partnering and lending funds out rather than the, you know, so the criteria that that is contained in the framework is around the communities that we want to serve, and you know, who's being helped really is kind of what the framework says now, right? Who and a little bit of how. We'll be enhancing the how part with some of the new environment, the Measure 102 environment. So the basic community ideas are not, I don't think, are going to change at all.
I think that's where my question is, Carl. I mean, so do you, and for all of you, do you envision this change in the constitutional amendment changing that environment and playing field in a significant enough way that it would impact that original community framework? So for instance, does it shift the model enough towards new development to be different than what we originally talked about, or away from acquisition, all those kinds of things? I don't feel like it doesn't, but
yeah, folks have other ideas. That's great. You're sort of anticipating my sort of next set of comments, but okay. But yes, I mean, I think that's what I wanted to talk to you about. I know it's sort of opaque there. It says revised financial model, but there's actually those questions that you're asking, Alan, are sort of key to that. What assumptions we're going to make around lending funds. So the next piece is that, I'll just say in a broad summary, that Measure 102 allows us to lend funds. We have, the Bureau has a long history of lending funds and putting them out through competitive means. So I'm just going to whiz right into number four here. So what that has meant traditionally is that we put out a notice of funding availability or something similar. An open and competitive solicitation. We ask for proposals. We have general criteria in those proposals, NOFAs, depending upon what year it is, what the funding sources, what have you. The main difference here is going to be that we have a set of goals, which you've all seen over and over again, that we are still bound to. So we still have, you know, minimum of 1,300 units. We still have 650 family units. We still have 630% units. We still have goals around permanent supportive housing. Those goals aren't changing. What's changing is that we have, to some extent, maybe less control, maybe. I think that's really what the conversation is, because we'll be asking our partners to meet those goals for us. And so that's really the next piece of the real, to kind of dig into the next piece of the process, is how we're going to do that, how we're going to ask our partners to meet what's in the framework and the goals that we've all said publicly, and get them to do that for us. And sort of, it's a bit of a change of environment. We have, like I said, a little bit relatively more flexible with our funds in the past, just relatively speaking. Now we will be much more constrained. We have, you know, absolutely positively limited dollars, and we have goals that we really feel like we need to stick to. And that will, like I said, we'll be delegating that, so to speak, to our partners.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a good reminder, because, I mean, not only the number goals themselves, but there were also specific pieces that we controlled as the Bureau, right? That now that we go out to partners, we may not control. I think, for instance, screening criteria is one of those, right? I mean, so there have been a lot of pieces along the way. Yeah, I actually remember having these thoughts as this conversation came forward. And so now it is real. Now we really do have okay, so it'll be interesting to hear how those parameters will work and what you all are doing now, because you already have those partnerships and you obviously have some goals that you're trying to meet as a Bureau.
Those are great questions, and I think those are things we're anticipating being, like I said, sort of more inflexible than in the past. It says, so these are the program requirements we have developed already, like, you know, the sort of rent to income or screening criteria, what have you. We have developed these already. If you want to participate in this program, you will be using those criteria. I don't think there's sort of any going back on that. So some of that public outreach that Jennifer and Tanya are talking about is really to get feedback around that, to say, okay, you're now our partners in developing this. These are the requirements of the program. You know, what are the issues that you see as you go out there to try and sort of work with us in the public-private partnership to implement those things?
You guys didn't have enough to do already?
I guess I want to be clear on what are the parameters of the community engagement. What influence will the community have if we're operating off of the same criteria? We've already gone through this work of developing this screening criteria. I want to be clear, when wherever we're doing this, it's really clear what influence the community has on this. Is it sort of something like, for example, I know something that I think one of the reasons I was appointed is based on our work in East Portland on the Division Transit Project Corridor. And I know the community out there is still looking for some affordable housing for going in advance of that line. Is that what you expect to hear from communities or folks in the Southwest Corridor with the?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, Todd. Okay. So I think there's a couple pieces to it, at least I sort of think about off the top of my head. So one of them would be that we will now have, as I said to Alan, you know, that we'll have partners, and we need to sort of talk to our partners about, and that will be a piece of the conversation, is, you know, the partners that we work with already, new partners that might want to participate, and sort of just listen into, you know, what are the issues as a result of this? We know you want to develop affordable housing. You know, we know you want to be part of this program. What things would come up as a result of the sort of environment we're talking about? And then secondly, I think you're right, and this gets a little to your question, Alan, is that there is some more, I think, latitude because of the potential for increased funds. There's some more latitude around doing projects that we might not otherwise have been able to do, whether there are more projects altogether, whether those locations are different than they otherwise might have been. Those are the kinds of questions that we want to put out there. And I think your question around, can we meet, for example, Division Transit goal, is that more possible now that we have this sort of greater flexibility? And we want to ask those kinds of questions. Yeah. But I think your earlier question about, you know, the populations that we want to serve and all that early work in 2016, I don't think that's open for a conversation. Yeah.
Following along on these lines, two questions about implementing under the new constitution. So part of the intention of Measure 102 was to be able to partner with our non-governmental entities that weren't included under the old constitution, but also to be able to leverage other funding resources.
And so I appreciate hearing that the intention is not to go back on any of the criteria or commitments we've set through the framework and all the community engagement and all the policy creating we've done here at this table. However, I just want to make sure that we won't be tying our hands from being able to leverage other resources if some of the policies we've created aren't in alignment with the way other funding streams work.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jess. I think one of the, that's sort of the first, my first point about sort of legal questions, right, is that you know, working within other structures, for a low-income housing tax credit structure, for example, might have different criteria than our bond, and we want to answer those questions before we go out. So that's a great point.
Girl, I think the other piece is, you know, entering into partnerships like those, it's like getting married, right? And so we're entering into any contract. Like, that's not the way I see my marriage, but but you know, you want to address the upsides and the downsides. And an upside potential here is, isn't there also the possibility that we would see innovation come from the marketplace as you're partnering in the marketplace differently that we may not have had without the constitutional amendment? Whether it's innovations or cost cutting, right? I mean, those potentials exist also with this possibility.
Yeah, do you have anything in mind that were sort of general categories?
I don't, but I've heard things out there.
No, I think that's true. One of the things that I say is that, having done a little creative work in my life, that constraints kind of foster creativity, right? And so there will be constraints, right? There's an absolute number, there's $240 million available for development. We have an absolute number, many absolute numbers, but one of them is at least 1,300 units. So, you know, we will say back to our partners, well, you know, you might have a project where you want to develop units that cost $1 million each, right? And they'll just say, you know, that's not going to happen, right? So there are those kind of innovations out there.
Or conversely, 100,000.
Right, exactly. Very good point. Very good point. Yeah. Other questions on this topic? Yeah, so I'll go ahead, Jess.
The whole topic of Measure 102?
Well, so I'm going to talk just a little bit more about the NOFA process and some of the financial assumptions I think I've hit on most of them already, but I just want to be clear that what we're talking about is indeed increasing leverage, meaning that in the past, I think we had a very limited ability to leverage bond funds, or $240 million. We didn't think could stretch too much further than that, a little bit, but not too much. We do think that we can stretch it somewhat further. Right now, I'm revising the model that I did to early in 2016 to get us to this place of what were those numbers. So I'm working on that, and I'm expecting that it'll have a sort of variety of options around whether they're different locations or different balances of acquisition rehab versus new construction, you know, all sorts of different permutations, including potentially more units as well. So I'll be revising that model, working with my colleagues to kind of go through some of those things and just talk about what those options might be. The funds would go out, hopefully, and the first set of funds would go out in 2019. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's the first half of 2019, although that might be a little bit, maybe a little optimistic, we'll see. But we'd like to make the funds available through our traditional forum or format, which is a notice of funding availability. The process is well established. We think that it provides some sort of clarity to folks, some transparency, some fairness, and it also gives us clear criteria, which we will include from the bond. So the bond criteria will be inserted into the solicitation to say, here's what we expect from you, and it'll have presumably a dollar maximum for unit construction, or maybe, you know, plenty of other potential financial metrics in it. So we'll do that, we'll put it out. We don't know sort of how many projects we would expect in the first go around. I think it's a question internally of staff capacity to process those things. I certainly could imagine someone saying, let's do it all at once. You know, I think that that's not really practical from a staff capacity, but also we just want to learn from the process. So I think it makes sense to take it in chunks. So we'll be doing that as well. And so we would expect to do a similar kind of evaluation. We do an internal staff evaluation. We also have an external committee, which I would hope that at least one member of the bond oversight committee would be part of that evaluation process. And then, you know, eventually to make some decisions, hopefully, sort of towards the end of 2019. And have so sort of the next set of Measure 102 bond projects decided on sometime in 2019. Yeah, that's all.
Thank you for that that further description, Carl. That was my question, was going to be about a future NOFA process. We know from the partners who develop affordable housing that there are many projects already in a quote-unquote pipeline waiting for funding, competing in other NOFAs, maybe even having competed in NOFAs here previously, and the projects are in varying levels of readiness or, you know, fully funded. And I guess my question is, are there opportunities to look at those projects and find potential matches or help those projects shift slightly to become matches for a housing bond funding so that we are investing where capacity has already been invested and getting those projects further along in their process, and hopefully that means to the community more quickly and more efficiently.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Jess. I think we look to you and to Metro to help us with it. I know you've done some initial canvassing. We'll do some ourselves as well. You know, the process, I think, sort of the overall message I want to have is that it would be a competitive open solicitation. But, you know, we have flexibility about how to do that. So it would, you know, at least consider how to take advantage of sort of projects that can get going sooner rather than later. Yeah.
So in terms of thinking about that, if there was a project that had control of a site and had the interest to do, maybe they were potentially going to do a small number of 30% units and they wanted to do more, how would that work with getting the project base? I mean, would that be in the mix of this too if they came forward and said, we have a project but we could do more 30% units with...
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Susan. So I think one of our challenges is going to be we have sort of a limited number of vouchers for the program overall. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be other financial supports that we can bring in as the program goes on. We know for sure we have those 400 vouchers that we have?
400
vouchers. We know we have those available to us. We've used some of them already. You know, we would expect, we would say in our NOFA application, bring us this type of project and you can have this proportion or this number of vouchers, or maybe there's other rent support or other operating support that we could bring to bear at some point in the process as well. But we would clearly say, again, you're meeting the goals of the program, and this is one of those goals. So the last thing I just want to say, I think we have two other smaller pieces on the agenda. Last thing I just want to say is that the Powell project that you're all familiar with, it's obviously redevelopable land at this point. We've started some very initial feasibility study with Holst Architects, and it's, as I said, very initial. I think the new environment says to us that we may have opportunities to change the development scheme there in terms of who's in charge. So we'll be looking at that with our partners at Home Forward in the next month or two. I don't have anything to say definitively at this point, but it's certainly a possibility that we would change how we were thinking about that from a development perspective. And then I think we just want to give a timing schedule thing.
Oh,
you want to talk about the West one?
Of course. First, we're going to celebrate.
Are there any cats?
Because it's good to celebrate.
No cats.
Yes.
I'm fired.
Did you ever see a cat's life?
No.
Cats do live there.
Tanya had a slide, that internal slide, because you weren't at that meeting, just where there are cats on the windows. It's very, very cute. Oh, well, so you're supposed to celebrate now, right?
Oh, yeah. That was a great celebration.
Yeah, I know.
Yay!
I don't have music, so.
Yeah, okay, and then Denver, I think one last piece for you, right?
Sure.
You want to do schedule?
Yeah, sure. No. So, just briefly, we have finalized our 2019
bond oversight committee dates, and so you have those. I think those dates have been set and put on your calendar previously, but they're listed here. And then, thank you. And then also just an update as to look for the next year. We're going to be looking for appointing a new chair and vice chair. This is per the oversight committee's charter. And we will, it's just to let you know that we'll be looking into that. And I think also a new member will be appointed in the new year as well. So so in the charter, we have term limits of 1 year for each of those positions. And so just be kind of mulling that over. We'll get, we'll cover it in our next meeting, first meeting of the year.
Yes,
I'm sorry, I didn't respond on the West one. We should.
Like a drum roll.
Some of us, of course,
with
really vulnerable populations, said exactly, yeah, money on the table to give a symbol of how great it is, the Metro Bond Pass. But the most vulnerable population, that was a really significant property that I think some of us wouldn't have expected. And it's going to really be important to the people who traditionally been in that building. So I think it's fantastic we've got that building.
I really appreciate you pointing that out. I mean, obviously, this is a big part of why the public supported this bond, is that we could do these kinds of projects that otherwise don't get done. So thank you for that.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of work to be done if you've never been into that property, but still, it's very thrilling.
No, you're great. Fantastic.
Thank you very much. As you can see, there's a lot going on and much to think through. I've got a list here of names that have signed in and or signed up. Don't know if when you were signing in, if you knew you were signing up. But if you have a desire to come and give public testimony, you've got a 2-minute window to do so. I would ask you to come sit in front of that microphone. You'll push the green button so you can be heard, and you would have 2 minutes. If you would announce your name and if you have an affiliation with any specific entity, and then your 2 minutes would begin. So I will try to go through the list because some of the writing I cannot decipher. But if you are here and you wanted to say something, you've got a moment to do so. Come on up. You will have 2 minutes after you announce your name.
I'm Donna Cohen. I live in St. John's. I'm part of a citizen housing advocacy group there. I'd just like to say 3 things. Number one, thank you. This is fabulous, and I'm very excited about it. Number two, I'm sort of a one-person marketing effort in St. John's, because I'll be on Facebook and people will say, well, look what the city got, all that bond money, and not doing a damn thing, you know. It's like people don't know what they're talking about, but they talk anyhow, and then I try to set them straight. But if there's any ways you can do a little bit more marketing for, you know, what you're doing to communities, maybe next door would be one place, that would be great. And then the third thing, which I didn't come here planning to say, but Carl knows that our group actually has an opportunity to do an affordable housing project. We have a church that will donate land.
Wow.
Pardon me?
I just said wow.
Wow, yeah, right. And we've been kind of bottled up. We checked with the city about the bond and then learned that, well, you know, because the church wants to keep ownership of the land. So we are kind of ripe for a project, just to let you know. And we've been looking at different models, possibly a Bridge Meadows model, which you're probably familiar with. So anyways, Carl has our information. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I just add, thank you, Donna. Thank you for your advocacy and your leadership in St. John's. And also that I know finding a site in St. John's is a priority of ours, too, to help spread the investments across the city. We haven't been able to locate a project yet in North Portland or St. John's. So thank you.
Any other voices, people who are just chomping in the bit? Come on, sir. Yes, you, with the hand up. You're the only. You will again identify your name and then you will 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'm Bobby Weinstock. I work at Northwest Pilot Project. It's awesome to see the buildings that the bond has produced up on the screen like that. So congratulations to you all. Thanks for your incredible work to help us create more affordable options for people in this town. Two things I want to say. One, relating to the project-based vouchers that are going to be allocated by Home Forward, I'm hoping that the eligibility criteria will require that only folks who have a household income at 30% or below of median are eligible for those vouchers, because that's the only way to create affordability for folks at the lowest level of income. So I hope Home Forward will, or the bond committee will require that those vouchers go to folks at 30% of median or below. And the second point is that as you count the affordability of the units that the bond creates, I just want to make sure that if there's a 30% unit, so the rent is affordable to people at 30% of median, and there's a person who has income at 30% of median living in the unit, that would make sense to count that unit as a 30% unit that the bond created. But if there's a 30%, if there's a person who makes 30% or less of median income, but they're living in a 60% unit, like could happen at the LN10, it could happen at the West Wind, that unit isn't counted as a 30% affordable unit, it's counted as a 60% affordable unit, because that person is rent burdened. And so it's just a kind of a technical suggestion for how you do the count of affordability.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you did it within 2 minutes. Very impressive.
Do we have an answer on the vouchers being prioritized for households with the lowest incomes?
Yeah, I think that is one of our that's one of our requirements, that income income certification is the first step in any of the criteria to get a voucher.
And
income
certification at 30%.
At 30% or below. Come on up. On this point. Hi, Molly Rogers, Home Forward. Quick point of clarification with this, just following up on Bobby's testimony. HUD does not allow us to require an income designation of 30%, anything really less than 50% area median income, but we create workarounds by creating preferences for households that are earning 30% and area median income below. And that is the intended goal, is we want those vouchers to be targeted to our to that income range, but we have to create preferences as opposed to a requirement. And the way that that plays out is when we apply project-based Section 8s on existing units, we want to make sure there's enough 0 to 30 households there, because if there are not, we have to allow folks between 31 and 50% to get that voucher. So that's just a point of clarification. So we don't set so very clear on that.
So is that an issue at the Ellington? I mean, is there a worry that there won't be enough for the number of vouchers at 0 to 30%?
We think we're right in that perfect place to be able to deploy 52, because we know that not everyone who comes in through the process who is income qualified will be eligible for all the other requirements as part of the voucher. So there's nice to have a little bit of a cushion. There's not too much of a cushion, so we know that there won't be an excess of many people rent burdened or extremely rent burdened at that property. So yeah, but just a point of clarification, in case the small chance there are a couple people who might get a voucher who may be at 31 to 50%.
Thank you very much. Any other? Going once. Yes.
Hi. I'm Linda from PCRI. I just wanted to ask if, with the revision of the financial model, when that happens, is it going to be possible for co-op opportunities as far as new developments for especially for like seniors and but just any funds that could be released for something like that. Because I know it works for permanent affordability, but if it's a co-op opportunity where you're still holding the property, but you're, especially for those that are 30 to 60% AMI with fixed incomes.
Great question. I don't know if there's an answer now, but I think there's opportunity to have that conversation.
Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it. Well, everyone, thanks for coming to the Bond Oversight Committee meeting. I know that there's a lot of information that's being covered. And again, I'm going to ask all of the Portland Housing Bureau staff, if you identify yourselves, Portland Housing Bureau folks. Excellent. If you look around the room and you've got more questions and need to engage with them, please grab them. They've got the business cards and could not wait but to interact with you on this vital work. As you see, our next meeting is scheduled for February, and then April and July and October. I anticipate we'll probably have a cold meeting at some point during this process. Have a great day, everybody.